This is an interview with David Trubeck and Louise Grossman Trubeck on June 8, 2005 in Madison, Wisconsin.
So thanks again for meeting with me this morning. I hope it's you're both enjoying the summer and you've got some plans.
Oh yes, we just came back from a big conference that we were at, so we're just debriefing ourselves from that. And we're ready for this.
Well, good. Well, Dave and I talked about quite a few things last time, but I guess I did want to ask you, Louise, if you could kind of maybe give me a quick story about how I know you came to the UW through the Ford program, but you know, kind of where your background was and why you chose UW over there, a few other campuses you might have chosen.
I was raised in New York, in Brooklyn, and I went to, my parents were Jewish leftist, but they were not active politically. Well, that's not quite fair. My mother was active in very local PTA politics, which in those days had some significant political context to this. There was some recruiting of people for socialists and communists.
Really?
Yes. My mother was president of the PTA, and they put her up for some position. I suggest with the American Labor Party, it must have been, and my mother was just beside herself. So there was, at the very local level, where I was raised in Brownsville, which was a working class, and very much, there was a lot of political activity among some of the people that were there. I mean, certainly the execution of the Rosenbergs was just a huge issue. So I had that kind of background. My father was a wannabe intellectual, and he had gone to City College. And then had dropped out because of the Depression and had become a postman. And he was working then as a postman. But he read all the time and was you know, very much into intellectual, more than politics, is the way to describe it.
Now, were your parents, was your family, you mentioned they were Jewish, were they actively Jewish? Or?
No, they were not. They were that generation that was not. That was actually quite resistant, turned away from their very orthodox background. And we didn't even learn Yiddish with some of those people. So it was actually quite it was cultural Judaism as well. We lived in a Jewish neighborhood, and it was, but they were quite resistant. And my sister thinks that there was a push to make us Americans, you know, that period. But, you know, electively pulled back into the others, being raised in that area and with the Rosenbergs and the strong connection at the McCarthy area and so forth that started in the 40s in New York. But my father, because he was a wannabe intellectual, was very familiar with Wisconsin, and actually that remark in the On Wisconsin story, which was attributed to John Israel's father, saying he was very impressed and wanted him to go to Wisconsin, was actually my father. And John said he had mentioned something about an uncle, so John had kind of, because I said to him, isn't that interesting, John Israel's father also, so that was a little bit of a repertorial error.
Yeah.
But he was very impressed with Wisconsin. He was familiar with the John R. Commons and that kind of tradition. And in fact, they didn't have a choice, because in fact, you took examinations, but each of the schools had their own examination. Yes, and of course, the women could not go to Yale, for example. So even when they admitted women, there were only a certain number. And when I came in 57, after John was 55, the program had already lost a little of the glamour. And I think that the 57 class was not as as interesting or as intellectual as the 55, 56, I think, were the really great classes. 57, then it really petered out. It was a really very short period of time. So I took the examination in that summer of my... when I was turning 16, I wasn't 16 till the end of the summer, till August. I was admitted in June or July, got on the train and went to New York. And I went to Wisconsin, and it's a really, you know, I see now quite a bit my classmates of that period. And we all left from New York at Grand Central Station. It was quite a scene. But I was, I had been interested in, I mean, my view of my life, depends that I would be a congresswoman, right? Fairly early on, you know. So I was interested in politics and that kind of thing. It was in ILS, and but I can't really recall exactly how I got involved in this human relations, but obviously John indicated that I had, so to speak, taken his place as the activist and maybe the chair of that committee.
This was a student government committee.
Yes, well, student government was very important.
Right.
As you know, and Dave and I were both, and that's how we met. We were both involved in student government because they had these committees, so it wasn't just elected from the class as a whole. There were people who, so to speak, senatorial positions.
You were appointed.
Okay.
Appointed.
They were elected, though. There were people who were directly elected,
right.
And there
were
people
appointed
who
were student senators.
There were appointed, and that's what
and
we
I
were.
I was a student senator from the publications.
Yeah, and okay. I was from the what was called then human relations. Human relations has a whole different significance.
Right.
I realized then that, now when John mentioned it, that's the committee was called, and it was to do with, you know, social change or social activism,
right.
Really,
right.
I think.
Now, when would that committee, because I've come across references to that committee, the earliest one I've come across is maybe 1957, but that committee existed even earlier.
That's what John said.
Okay.
And I was surprised because I didn't recall that. But I didn't think I found it or anything like that. I was, and it's interesting, I was, the person who I think recommended me and may have been my sort of mentor in that regard was Martha Peterson,
mm-hmm.
who of course then had a very distinguished career, and I believe, is she still alive?
I believe she is.
Yeah, and living up in Door County. She was then Dean of Women Students, which was a big position then, even though of course we were very co-ed,
mm-hmm.
There was still, and she, I don't know how I got involved with her, but she knew me and was a little bit of a mentor to me. She may have been the one that recommended. I was a history major. I took some political science courses.
Mm-hmm.
But my appearance in this kind of the Cardinal came from that Human Relations Committee, came from being a student senate, and then involved in the 1960 clause on discrimination. And then
mm-hmm.
Dave and I got active on the membership list. We also had contact informally, of course, with all the Labor Youth League people and all those people, because
right.
there was a strong, the strong left group at Wisconsin, both politically and, of course, I was not involved in it at all. But in the histories, of course, there was the sexual revolution too going on, which I was not involved in. But that was going on, so it was not only what do you call cultural as well as
sure, political. Sure, okay. What kind of things, before we get into the membership list issue, which we just kind of touched on very briefly last time, but kind of left for this time, what kind of things did the Human Relations Committee do? You mentioned the 1960 clause.
There was something about housing, but I really can't remember what it was.
Okay. But it was a committee devoted to kind of human rights, civil rights issues.
Yeah, what we would call human rights, civil rights issues today.
Okay.
Right, exactly. This is pre all that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the 1960 clause was a kind of a major thing. It was a very early effort at the fraternities and sororities in terms of discrimination. There was some remaining discrimination. Of course, I was lived at Gross Co-op, so there was an ongoing. There was an interracial world there, and you know, Lorraine Hansberry, Raisin in the Sun. That whole scene, you know, that is about Gross Co-op.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you should take a look at it. That scene when they talk about. It's a big scene where we talk about interracial and discrimination, and I can't remember exactly, and some confrontation between a white student and a black student. That was all in Burroughs Co-op.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, based on her experience. She was here for a year or 2 years. I mean, at least that's always been what I thought and other people thought came out of that experience. Yeah, so Burroughs Co-op was a very significant place. And
it was a women's cooperative dorm.
It was a women's cooperative dorm.
And it was in the same building as the Green Lantern.
Well, Green Lantern was in the basement, right. And I ate at the Green Lantern for 3 years.
Oh, okay.
Except for my first year where they enrolled us in a place. The women, you know, they put us in a certain place and they made us eat in a certain place. But then the next year, I moved to Girls Co-op for only 1 year, but I continued to eat at the Green Lantern.
Okay.
There is, by the way, an emeritus professor at the law school, if you're interested in that aspect of it, Jim Jones, who would love to go on and on and on about this, about Burroughs and the Green Lantern.
Okay.
And he gave me a description of Burroughs that he has, I put it upstairs, I can get it to you, but he can get me a copy, which is a kind of a promotion for it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a relationship. Now, I was not like these what we now call African Americans or then called black women, were involved in what I was doing in the Human Relations Committee. It was a very different group.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't come out of that, but I was definitely in Girls Club, so it was sort of in the milieu, I guess.
Yeah.
But they were not, it was not like a social movement, or I worked with them and organized them, no.
Right. Now, were there, so there were black students in Girls Co-op?
Absolutely. It was very strong multiracial. And when you read the description of it, that's a very strong aspect of it.
Jim Jones is black.
He's black, yeah.
He was actually here, I mean, it would be interesting to get his perspective. He's 81, I think, now. Mm-hmm. He was actually, had already gotten a master's degree before he came here. He was going to law school.
You mentioned did you live in the same house for a short time?
No. He was the cook in the Green Lantern.
Okay.
And me and a bunch of other people who lived down in Shorewood had this sort of social world that included a lot of people from the Green Lantern Girls Co-op crowd, and Jim was there, but he never actually lived there.
Okay.
So his... And as Louise is warning him, we don't want this on the record,
but he does have a lot, and he apparently does have some documentation, he does have this thing. So that Girls Co-op and that, and the Greenland.
If you want a perspective from, he was not your typical Wisconsin student at the time. He'd been in the Navy in the Second World War, he had done graduate work, so he was at law school. He must have finished law school just about 57.
Mm-hmm. But he certainly could give you a perspective on the black students then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he was quite friendly with any of the people in the Girls Co-op. But I can't say that there was any kind of proto civil rights movement or anything that I saw. But these were students. And they came from Chicago, a lot of them. Lorraine Hansberry, I think, came from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Is my recollection of that.
Now, were there black students as well involved in the Human Relations Committee, or was that?
I have no recollection.
I don't remember. Okay.
I don't remember many black students at all, except the ones I thought that I knew at Groves.
Right. Well, it's hard to pin down numbers. I've had a hard time kind of pinning down how many black students are actually.
Very few.
And in fact, Groves is a good tip into that, because they were significantly aimed at multiracial. You know, there were these co-ops that dated from earlier that had a very reformist kind of thing, and there were a couple of them are still surviving, and Green Lantern survived well into the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
They moved to University Avenue, and then they finally, when we came back, they were here for several years. I could never get myself to go over there. They moved, and I don't think it had much of the same, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the Groves didn't last too much longer. Well, they both ripped down the building.
Right. The building was for the chemistry.
Yeah, it must have been at the eastern corner of the corner. I'm not sure exactly, but I think that's where it was. It was on West Johnson Street. So when they built the chemistry building, which I think they built in the late 50s or early 60s.
Now, were you aware, either through your work in the Relations Committee or through the Daily Cardinal or just your presence on campus, of discrimination on campus? Was that, did people believe that there was discrimination on campus?
Well,
or?
The fraternities and sororities were, definition, they were, and they had, if they didn't, they would have been booted out of their national if they had complied with the 1960 clause, because at that time it was in the national charters that they had to discriminate. And so, so it was based on a theoretical, it wasn't like black students were clamoring. So it was a pre-social, it wasn't a social movement at that time. And I write about this all the time now, so I'm probably be overthinking this. the relationship between, legal professionalism, which is what I showed, and their relationship to social movements. This was clearly something done by concerned...
White liberals,
mm-hmm. Right. It was a white liberal move. It was significant, though, because it got a lot of attention, and it was considered to be somewhat radical at the time, because we were confronting the fraternities and sororities, and nobody cared about it. It was a conscious and sort of a consciousness-raising thing in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that it led to the civil rights movement or anything
right.
like that, even though I do think that Wisconsin invented the 60s and the 50s and the 60s. That's what Dave and I position it, but. But it was definitely that. And John indicated that he had started on that before. And it may not even have been, I probably picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
I have no reason to believe that isn't so.
Yeah.
And it was part of my my portfolio. And I do remember something about housing, but I don't remember exactly what it was. And we were, another thing that's interesting, maybe compared to now, is there was very little relationship to the city. In other words, it was very much university focused on university. Now, when the state came down on the university through the membership list, that's how we were involved. But we were not up there in the Capitol. We weren't volunteering in the poor neighborhoods or anything like that.
Right.
So that's, but the housing thing comes to mind, that maybe we were involved with conditions of housing.
You were. I remember something.
Yes, there was something about housing. So that is something that indicates we were involved in something in the community.
Yeah. Well, it seems from some of the reading I've done that there was an issue of private residences that were university approved that were discriminated.
Oh, well, that's what it is.
That's what the issue was.
That's what it was. But it related to the university.
Right.
It wasn't that we were going over there and saying, you know, look, there's Section 8 housing and they're discriminating. The kind of thing people do now.
You didn't have Section 8.
Well, I mean what I'm saying, the equivalent of Section 8. We didn't do that then. I mean, it's interesting in retrospect looking back because, of course, I'm involved in the law school of clinical education. We have, you know, we're out there all the time doing all kinds of things in the community. I'm up there all the time on healthcare and all these things, through, and my students are.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall any of that. Now, there was legal aid at the law school, but on the undergraduate level, I don't remember anything like that.
You know, I remember going to Milwaukee, working in the slums, and cleaning up
town. Okay, so what group was that with?
As an undergraduate?
Yeah, but only maybe once or twice.
Well, I have no recollection of that.
I don't know whether it was Quakers or Groves. I know Breida Brown was involved. That's probably why I did it.
Sure.
<Yeah.
laughs> An old girlfriend. But I don't know. But I'm interested in how striking that difference is. And now there's much less interest in, well, I can't say that. There's student councils and student tuitions and so forth. So you sort of have different movements.
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic point is that there was no movement of blacks for that. The anti-discrimination project on campus, to the extent that there was one, was driven by white liberals. That the big issue was the 1960 clause, but there was this other thing. I just remember, I had this vague memory of talking to you about it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a huge issue when membership list became. By the way, this is granting that I see that the big issue of the year was faculty salaries. It seems to come up like 40 times. Every different second issue, the card is talking about faculty salaries.
The need to increase salaries to retain good faculty?
Okay.
Maybe we should hit the membership list. Now I've read through some of these articles as well to kind of refresh my memory of this. But maybe you can tell me a little bit about what you remember about what the university was trying to do and how you reacted to it and how others were responding.
The pressure came from outside the university. It wasn't initiated, as far as I know, by people inside the university. Some head of the American Legion, whose name I now can't remember, was identified as one of the primary sources. It was presented as a neutral policy. We just want to, you know, have people publicly declare their membership. It was taken for granted by everybody, or most everybody, that this would effectively eliminate organizations like the Labor Youth League, which were on the Attorney General's list. You got to start from the Attorney General's list.
Came out in the late 40s?
Remember, we're talking now 55. Loyalty Oaths and the Attorney General's list were of the order of the day. People in California were being fired from schools because they wouldn't sign loyalty oaths.
There was a big case in Wisconsin, actually, of a professor, right? Law case, which went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, was that in the 60s, early 60s by the time it went up there? That's a very famous case.
About a loyalty oath?
Loyalty oath, and he was not in the Madison campus. He was in one of the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember which, but it's part of the University of Wisconsin.
Well, that was before the system. There was no system.
Before system. Roth versus somewhere else. It's a very famous case. So, yeah. It's hard to recall. Now, remember that we knew the people who were involved. It's well known that they that labored the youth week, and they in that time you needed three names. You know, you had to be two names. Mm-hmm. And as Dave said, the Communist Party, they recruited people, or whoever you want to say was behind. You know, there's no doubt that they were a communist organization.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I mean, at that time, everybody resisted that story, but just like Alger Hiss, I mean, it's clear that it was. Mm-hmm. It was clear there was a group of communists. Now, you know, we have a different view towards them than we did then, but then it was very scary. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, the Rosenbergs had been executed, mm-hmm. and nobody believed that they did. Many people believe that they didn't do anything, and many people to this day, of course, most people today don't think they didn't deserve to be executed.
Right, right.
So, I mean, this was, you know, this was not, and we knew people in New York who were, you know, fired from their jobs, who were fear. Everybody, it was a big, fearful time in New York when I came here, in the early 50s. Adade's family knew people and all that, so it was from the people we were involved, we knew it from the East Coast. Was a big thing. So the Labor Youth League, and these people were sent from the East Coast to Wisconsin. And Wisconsin was the only chapter left then. So everybody knew all this.
Right.
It wasn't as if we were idealistic liberals who didn't think that this was some kind of neutral thing. We knew that it was about free speech, and we knew about alternatives, and we knew that these people were people who were here to be agitators, and that, you know, it wasn't that we didn't know any of this.
I think you may be making a ton. I mean, we suspected. We thought it might be. We didn't know. The word "no" is all in retrospect. That's my first point. But I mean, basically, we felt that we knew real people who would, and I believe that some people talked to me and probably do, and they don't remember it, because don't forget that the people who were those you had to come forward with two names, and you had to certify that there were 10 others or 12 others. I can't remember. I remember 2 and 12. And we knew people who were on the unpublished list of 12. Saul Landau. I think the name Saul Landau is very important. This is apropos, absolutely.
He's around. You know, I mean, his name comes up all the time. So he was in Madison doing movies with his son.
Right. I was in touch with him a while back, although I haven't quite made the final connection.
You know, I had this incredible experience. I've just become professor emeritus, or will at the end of this month, and I get all this stuff from the state pension board, whatever it's called. And they have a list of people who have retirement accounts that the people have lost, and one of them is Nina Landau, and it has to be the same Nina Landau as Mary Thor, who must have worked for the state or the university at some point and then disappeared. I tried to find her on Google, but I couldn't.
I want to say something else. I don't know how much Dave said about this, but I want to backtrack from my discussion about We Were Knowledgeable. Many people in the left group, and they were socialists and they were communists, strong mm-hmm. socialists like Bert Ullman and mm-hmm. so forth, mm-hmm. viewed Dave and I as liberal dupes mm-hmm. who were doing the work for them. You know, we were fronting for them. So, I mean, it's important to realize that this was really quite, I always tell the story about somebody came up to me. Did Dave tell you the story that somebody came up to me and said, it's really good, Louise, that you've recruited Dave to this cause. You know, viewing me as more of a leftist than Dave, which is probably true mm-hmm. in a certain sense. I mean, Dave's always been, he was in ROTC, and
right,
he was
right.
much more, I was much more on the far end. I was much more of a, appeared to be and probably was more of a, an agitator than Dave. But I mean, it's really interesting, you know, in retrospect to understand that this, you know, just like we were, you know, I suppose our whole life that's what we've ended up being, liberal dupes or whatever you want to call it. But I mean, that's what we persisted in the rest of our, you know, and there's all kinds of stories about what we did later too. But I mean, in that context, which was quite left mm-hmm. at that time, you know, definitely on the continuum, we were kind of in the middle centrist, even though in fact this is this tiny world. So I mean, I think on the membership list thing, we did the right thing. At the time, we didn't know how connected these people were.
Suspected, but
didn't know as it came out. You know, a lot more. But mm-hmm. On the other hand, the people who were harassing them wanted, you know, were doing it for you know, reasons of suppressing discussion and so forth. But it was a very important experience in our lives, I think, because because it's not the last time that we got involved in things like this. And so, anyway, it was, and we won.
We won.
Of course, and you know, that also emboldened us. You know, I said in this article in On Wisconsin that the experience of going to college when you're 16 and being able to do that, it makes you think that you can do a lot of things. Gives you a kind of perhaps false courage, and so did our winning on the membership list.
Yeah, yeah. There must be a second. This is only half the year, right?
No, I think it's the whole academic year.
January 23rd, 1957.
Oh, you're right.
So there must be a second one volume, but I don't know where it is.
You know, when I went back, because I read through these, at one point I read through all the Daily Cardinals, and I made, you know, made notes to myself, dates and headlines and things like that. And when I went back, I think it was in June of 57 that the Student Life and Interest Committee officially kind of backtracked.
Student Life and Interest, Slick.
Slick. But
that was just before we left, right.
I think it has to be a little earlier because we would have gone, well, I don't know.
No, the year was much longer.
Okay, well, in any way, I think there's something that I don't fully understand, and you need to clarify it. If you figure it out, let me know. I think the Labor Youth League, actually, I know they must have, they certainly folded before June of 57, because I wrote an article for the Milwaukee Journal, which was an obituary, and I was going through here, and I found an editorial lamenting the failure, the closing of the Labor Youth League.
Yeah.
It's in here, and must have been written by Kim Willinson.
Yeah, look at, is this fall of 56?
Yeah.
Look at October 2nd. I made some notes to myself. Yeah, the Labor Youth League left in the fall of 56. It folded.
Because I was also editor for Octopus, by the way.
I think it's October 2nd, but there is a Cardinal article.
October 11th. Faculty salaries. They didn't get. I mean, there's 100 articles in here about faculty salaries, I'm telling you. New budget includes faculty raises. October 2nd. Yeah, that's it. Last night, with the announcement that the Labor Youth League has finally succumbed to the capine brushes of the American Legion, university refusal to accept its offices and lack of membership seems likely. So you see, the membership list campaign goes on after the Labor Youth League closed, and that's which I didn't quite really remember.
Right, my sense was.
By the way, I think Willinson. I would say almost to a certainty, Willinson must have been there.
You got that in trouble?
Yeah, I think so. This is really quite a poignant editorial, actually.
How did Kim go on to do?
He was a journalist. The last time I know, he was working for Newsweek, but I don't know. It's been a long time. Okay, so.
So, the membership list actually postdates.
Yeah. It postdates the closure of the Labor Youth League, and of course, that may well have been one of the motivations of recognition. Because it says here, it's finally succumbed to the combined pressure of the American Legion, university refusal to accept its offices and lack of membership. I don't know about the university refusal to accept its offices.
Well, there was a... you know, not to get too down into the details here, but there was a concert in the spring of 56, a Pete Seeger concert.
That's a very famous concert in my life.
Sponsored. And apparently Slick took them to task because they misscheduled it, or it was a music program and they weren't allowed to have music programs, or there was some complication. And the punishment was that they had to, the two officers... at the time, in the spring of 56, could no longer be the officers.
Oh,
and they had
I
to
see.
Come up with new officers.
I see.
And that was one of the kind of immediate issues in this folding. But.
Now, you know... Oh, there it is. See? Is my name spelled wrong? they spelled it right wrong in the headline and right in the gun.
A student newspaper.
But you know... Did I tell you the story about what that Pete Seeger... concert meant to me? Oh my God, wow, this is very important. This is extremely important. So, I was in ROTC, and I was a stringer for the Milwaukee Journal. And I covered that concert, and I wrote a story for the Milwaukee Journal. So when I applied for a commission, which you do in your, I don't know, in the summer before, you, I guess in the fall.
You did tell me a little bit about this, yes.
I applied for the commission. I had, you had to sign a loan appeal, and you had, it was, had the Attorney General's list on. And it said, have you ever attended a meeting sponsored by a Navy's group? Well, technically, I had attended a meeting sponsored by a Navy's group. So I checked it off, and thinking, you know, well, honestly, it's the best policy. Wow. So I was then called down to the, you know, the federal building, now the old post office, and interviewed by two guys who had flown out from Washington from military intelligence for 5 hours in a little room on every aspect of my life, my family, my friends, my contacts, on the grounds that, you know, if I'd been at this meeting, I must have been some kind of commie. And I kept saying that I was there as a journalist. Of course, because my life intersected with a lot of the people who they knew about, which was also extremely interesting that they knew a lot about the politics of a lot of students. Did I know how to do this? I guess. Ted Cloak. I remember being asked about Ted Cloak. Ted Cloak was the son of Professor Lawrence, and his sister, Andrea, was a friend of mine who I knew. And for some reason, I remember, I don't know why Ted Cloak, you know, stands out, but anyway. And this was probably before the membership list issue was heated up, but I can't remember the chronology. All of this went on in my senior year. The Labor Youth League closed down. I wrote the thing. I had the thing with military intelligence. We did the membership list fight. And I suspect that, you know, they all were happening all at the same time, but I don't have to come out.
That's how we met, you know, and that's how eventually we got together, and then we got engaged.
Through the membership list.
We knew each other, of course, we were, but we were not romantically involved at all till January or February of that year.
That late.
So we always laugh about it, you know, because in the end we've ended up working on and off with each other for now close to 50 years, so that was a very, very important, sort of symbolic time, and the liberal dupe thing too. So there you go.
Liberal dupes on the move.
Now, maybe we can get a little further into the liberal versus left. I mean, what do those names mean then?
Well, we were definitely considered to be left.
Okay.
But in retrospect,
you and Dave. Although maybe you
me more so than Dave, okay. But because, you know, everybody else was, I don't know what. I mean, you know, there wasn't that much politics, right? Mm-hmm. It was the Eisenhower's, whatever. Now, I participated, Jim Citrick reminded me of this, we used to have mock conventions, and I was involved in the mock Democratic convention.
Mm-hmm. So was I.
Yeah, so that was a big thing. So we did, those things would be considered liberal.
Right.
But what was politically active in Wisconsin that we were involved in was, now would be considered definitely progressive left. It wasn't people, isn't this right that it was not traditional, how can I describe it? Centrist Democratic Party people, we were not. We were interested in change, we were interested in activism, and there were people of warring positions. I mean, it was Trotskyite. I mean, really, there was this very active, that's what you're writing about, this very active group at Wisconsin. And so those are the people we interacted with. So in that group, we were on the far right. But to say we were liberals, I mean, I wouldn't consider myself a liberal today, though I don't know. I was just accused of being a neoliberal because of the work I'm doing right now on, I'm thinking about it, it's funny, because I'm writing about, how can I work this in? New ways in which law and government are working, which are, we consider, you know, post the third way, you might call it, or post privatization and trying to bring social values and kind of thing. So, you know, since we're probably back to that again. Anyway, so, there definitely were people at Bertel Ullman who were socialists, came here very active, and then were labeled Youth League, and we were to the right of that. But how much to the right, I don't know. I mean, my family was my father was, as I say, a wannabe intellectual. Mm-hmm. He could talk endlessly about this stuff, but he never did anything. So I was very into the doing, not the talking. And this has been a big strain in my life, actually. Strain meaning both senses of the word strain. And so Dave was the intellectual and I was the doer. And that's been a sort of role that we're trying to get out of, I'm trying to get out of for a long period of time. So that was very important in that, in understanding. And I was more left, why? Because I lived in Gross Co-op, because I was mm-hmm. poor. Dave comes from a much, much higher social class than I did. Mm-hmm. I was from the New York left community, would be too strong a word, but I was just, you know, part of that. I was very working class community, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were, I mean, because of the Rosenbergs, because a lot of the people that my family knew were, you know, they were just low-level people, but those issues came up and they felt very threatened by the what was happening with McCarthy. And that was a real thing. But I didn't associate Wisconsin with that. Dave was involved in the Jomo Spill and all that. I wasn't mm-hmm. involved in that.
No, but by being active in this membership list fight, you kind of indicated that you were against kind of McCarthyism, against, in favor of civil liberties, free speech, those kinds of things.
Right.
In the larger sense of the Cold War, how would you have seen yourself at the time vis-a-vis the Soviet Union? If you had known all these folks on the left, if they had declared that they were communists, out-and-out communists, would that have changed your opinion of them?
Probably not. And in fact, I had a very positive view in many ways towards the Soviet Union, being an example of a more equal society. And my father said to me, you know, he went to Russia, when was that day? In the 70s, mm-hmm. the 80s, you know, just as a trip. Mm-hmm. And he said to me when he came back, when he saw the living conditions, he said, what a terrible thing we believed all day. So it was well into that period. So I was still part of, you know, there was a substantial number of people, this is not unheard of, so that I would say yes. On the Cold War, I was not a Cold Warrior, absolutely not. I was one of those people who were, what do they used to call them? Commie simps.
Com-simps.
Com-simps, huh?
Yeah, com-simps.
Never heard of com-simps?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fellow traveler and a lot of
yeah, com-simps. But probably not enough to have ever gone to a labor youth league meeting, because mm-hmm. I was very frightened. I mean, I really had come from New York, where this was a big thing going
but
on.
Didn't your uncle lose his job in the New York City government?
My uncle was a communist in Detroit.
No, the other uncle, Max. Didn't he get in trouble?
Yeah, I think so. That's right. You remember that. I don't remember that. Yeah. I had an uncle who was sent out and worked to organize the auto workers, mm-hmm. And who was definitely part of a communist whatever relationship. I never yeah. fully understood that.
Yeah.
And then he eventually drifted away. I mean, he talked about it. When we went to see him about a couple of years ago, we talked about it. Because he read, you know, my father would talk about the work we were doing and all that. My father was very, he subscribed to the Daily Cardinal. He read all of these articles. So,
just checking up on
him. Right. So I mean, I think that definitely we were, but also not to forget that Dave and I, that's why we were the dupes, because we were part of the student government. We were not part of the fringe mm-hmm. in that sense. We got ourselves into the conventional running of the university, mm-hmm. and we have therefore had some positions of influence.
I was an editor, one of the editors of the Daily Cardinal.
Yep.
Editor of the Literary, mm-hmm. editor of the Human Rights. In ROTC, I won the prize for the Outstanding Junior of the Year.
Iron Cross, you mentioned?
I was in Iron Cross.
Did you get the prize there, San Junior?
Yeah, I did. I got $100. That's a lot of money. Yeah. We know exactly how much it was. It's
$500.
$700.
$700,
huh? Yeah, $100. I don't know what I did with it. I spent it all on wine, women, and snoring, probably. But I was sort of in between. I was kind of this strange in between this sort of. There was both a left world and a bohemian world.
Yes, that's right. That's
and this
what I
is
meant
very,
by the cultural world.
Very important to understand yeah. that there was a left political world and a sort of radical cultural revolution world.
And those two overlapped?
They overlapped.
Okay.
very much overlap. And, you know, I think that you would find, and this is just a guess, but you would find that if you tried to locate the sort of institutional nexus, you would find it as graduate students in American history, that graduate students in American history were extremely important players in this whole world. Mm-hmm. Lauren Barrett, I think Saul Landau, that's what he was, Marty Sklar, a lot of these people.
I think Marty started as an undergraduate and went on to, some of them started as undergraduate and
Gar Alperovitz went on to do graduate work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that, you know, this was when you had William Appleton Williams actually came just after we left, but he was a major figure. And there was this world, and I think, and you know, here's another thing, you know, we knew each other very slightly from ILS, but I really saw more of Louise first when she went out with my roommate, who was an economist. He was doing a doctoral degree in economics. And I lived in this world, this graduate, in my senior year, I lived only with graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was the graduate student world and the sort of left intellectual undergraduate world were
very, very connected.
Connected. So this kind of mixture of cultural revolution, sexual experimentation, use of drugs. There was some use of drugs, mostly
marijuana,
and you know.
What was that thing?
This Mexican thing.
What do you call it? The thing that what's his name smoked? Mesquite. What is that? Gives you the hallucination.
I'm showing my ignorance.
Well, some of these anthropologists.
Sort of passed out. Mezcal?
No, it's terrible because it begins with a P. Peyote.
Peyote.
Okay.
So some of these anthropology graduate students were bringing these drugs back from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to sort of, it wasn't a big thing, but you had a drug scene. You had a folk music scene.
Mm-hmm.
Pete
mm-hmm.
Seeger was just the tip of the iceberg. You had a you know, sexual experimentation scene. You had left politics going from, you know, Henry Wallace to Trotsky. You had, you know, to people who were actually, you know, secret members of the Communist Party. So this was the world. That's why we always say that Wisconsin invented the 50s, the 60s, because a lot of, you know, so many of the elements of the 60s except a strong emphasis on and even racial discrimination was there. It just wasn't it was more focused on you know, economic justice than it was on racial justice, but that was there. Now, you asked about the Cold War and the Soviet Union. So Louise has told her story. I think my story is a little bit different. I had no historic family connect. Well, first place, of course, my family, we're all in business or the professions. My father was a very successful small businessman. His brothers were all corporate executives, or one was engineers or doctors. And my grandfather, who had actually come to the United States from Latvia, but came with a doctorate in chemistry and immediately from Russia, it wasn't Latvia, it was from Riga. You know, he had a technical education in a German-speaking university. He had made a lot of money in the 20s in business. He started his own business and did quite well. So on the other hand, my father was sort of a maverick and was attracted to left-wing causes. He bankrolled the nation for quite a while. He funded Robert Hutchins' Center for Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara, which was a very important institution at that time, because it was a big spokesman for free speech, civil liberties, you know, academic freedom, all those things. It was an anti-McCarthy project funded by the Ford Foundation, and then it attracted a lot of individual donors. So my father, and he sort of hung around with, but didn't feel part of, a kind of New York intellectual world. But he was also active in Democratic Party politics and was the finance manager for Kefauver's run for the presidency. He was rather close to Estes Kefauver. I mean, very close. And so I'm sort of come from a rather different background. And I never felt I thought of the Henry Wirtises and the Saul Landaus and the Lauren Barrettses. I thought they were the other. But they were people who ought to have their right
to
speak.
He was a true liberal in that sense. Had the right to speak, but he didn't necessarily.
I was a true liberal, and I was attracted. I was attracted to some kind of idea of an alternative social organization and a critic of capitalism. But I didn't have I had very ambivalent feelings about the Soviet Union until Hungary, and then that was the end of that. Mm-hmm. Now, Hungary, don't forget, Hungary happened in our senior year.
That's why, you see, I was definitely more in that sense to the left than Dave. I mean, we clearly were, you know, because I was much more sympathetic to the more just of the socialist model than Dave was, who came from business. But we were certainly not neocons. We were certainly not people who had turned against the Soviet Union in the 50s. Not at all. In fact, I don't know a person like that of that group. I mean, this was this group, and then there were those people who were apolitical, as far as I was concerned. I don't remember anybody who would fall in the category of a neocon who was at the university in the student group world that we knew. I mean, these I'm sure there were children of the American Legion people there, but do you have any recollection of anything?
No, and you know, it's interesting because I've just read two books of the early days of the CIA, which is called The Old Boys. It was a terribly written book. Unfortunately, a terribly written book about a fascinating subject. And what struck me was the extent of organized anti-Soviet thinking in the United States, and the extent to which, you know, there was real support for some kind of, I mean, not just a Cold War, but for a hot war against the Russians, right? You know, and you know, literally people said, let's have a preventive war before they get the bomb and all of that. And of course, you know, I've never read Gar Alpovitz's famous book. Have you? So I gather, you know, this was a big thing to discover that and to put forward the argument, which has now been, I think, more or less accepted then. That they dropped the bomb as much to frighten the Russians as to bring the war in Japan to an end, because the war in Japan was going to end anyway, and the bomb didn't do much more damage than we had done with firebombing in Tokyo. Last firebombing raid in Tokyo killed 100,000 people, and now I think that Hiroshima was much less than that. But, you know, I mean, of course the potential was there. So I think that I never realized, and I certainly didn't know anybody who would come, we certainly know here, nor in my family connections do I ever remember anybody saying, you know, Russia's absolute evil, we have to destroy them, it's a threat to protect none of that. None
so
of
you,
that.
You didn't, there wasn't that group amongst the student population that
not
you
that,
were
Oh,
there
was, I'm sure there, well, it may have
it
been
It may
such
have
a
been,
group.
But we certainly didn't know that.
You didn't
when
see
we,
the student government?
No, or, when we fought, it was more apathy the way we do. And Helen Rabin, who was the president, was a sterling person. A very fair, excellent person, you know, who was a really outstanding person, went on to have quite an interesting career herself, unfortunately died a few years ago. And she was a real person that you could talk to and persuade, and she was very connected with the fraternities and the sororities. This was on more on 1960, maybe on membership lists too. So she represented the group that we were trying to convince, really. And I don't remember there being any of that kind of, now, obviously there may have been, but, you know, that's Wisconsin, and that's one of the things that allowed all this to flourish, I think, was that there was, and the law school has proved to be the same, you know, that there is no real strong conservative element. It allows a flourishing of kind of unconventional views, and Dave and I, with all our criticisms of the Wisconsin Law School, and when people talk about their law schools, they always say, you just can't realize how freeing it is not to have that there all the time. And so so Wisconsin, in our view, and I mean, you can read the Daily Cardinal, of course, was run by the left people, progressives, but I just don't think there was there's nothing like the Badger Herald, there was nothing. I mean, it seemed to be apathy on the other side. And maybe people who learn. Now, people like Jim Citrick or Helen Rabin, Jim Citrick was a classmate of ours from that period, who seems to have been a centrist political scientist.
How do you spell his last name?
Sitrick.
He's going to be here in September.
Yeah. He went to the Yale Law School in the same class as me. And so he emerged as and he's been a very successful corporate lawyer, and now he's involved with the UN, the Friends of the UN So they're bringing him back. But now he was an example of somebody I barely knew. He remembers me, talks about this in terms of the mock Democratic Party. But if he asked about a view of me or Dave, I'm sure he would say, you know, I was some kind of leftist. And Dave was a big man on campus. I mean, he was not viewed as left as I was because he had all these other, you know, the literary magazine and all that. He had a more complex image, I think, than I did.
Talking about apathy, I think apathy is very important. I'm going to run upstairs because I realize it and look and see the other part of it to see if I can find the other volume.
The second half of this.
But also see if I can find the I don't know if I ever kept the new ideas. I wrote an editorial, I seem to remember, in one of those new idea issues, which is basically an essay against apathy. So I think we felt that it was a fight.
Yes.
That the struggle was between
politically
active people and you know, just politically apathetic people who were also not intellectually oriented or oriented toward a career, but just having a good time. It was a battered block. I remember somehow I have this memory. You know what Badger Block was? That was, you know, they used to have this thing that in the football stadium. The people would have cards, everybody would have cards, and then they'd different colors, and then they'd make words and pictures with the cards. And I remember sitting in an English class in which it was pretty clear that the three people in front of me were just playing, they were listening to the word the professor was saying. and they were playing in the Badger Block thing for the afternoon. And you know, it was this whole sorority scene and the sort of campus party scene. So this is another thing, of course, that because there was in that time a much larger percentage, I think, of out-of-state students.
Of out-of-state students.
Or at least that it was a
very distinct group that
distinct
came from out-of-state.
And so Louise was in the center of that distinct group, Groves Co-op, and this distinct group had three physical bases, as I remember.
The Rathskeller,
Rennebaum's at the corner of University and Park, and Groves Co.
Rennebaum's was a drugstore?
It was a drugstore.
That's a big fight to say. Do you have been reading about that?
Not the one they're trying to say. Now, you can continue. I'll just see if I can find the other one.
On your way back, look in that file cabinet in my office. You know, that one we have, there's one that says Louise.
In the door?
Behind the door.
In the closet? Yeah,
take up the file cabinet. It says Louise. That has the thing on Groves Co-op from that Jim gave me. I might as well give it to you.
I better get a flashlight because there's no light in it. And that part of the attic.
Well, Dave's gone. Let me ask you something that I didn't talk to him about, but I wanted to make sure to talk to you about. I wanted to ask you about women.
Yeah.
And, you know, you wouldn't have called them issues of gender at the time. Maybe you would have, I don't know. But how you remember those issues from your time as an undergraduate?
Well,
your expectations?
Right. Well, I think about it a lot because immediately after I graduated, I went to the Yale Law School. Mm-hmm. And that was a tremendous shock to me. There were 160 people, and there were 6 women.
Yeah.
And many of the men had gone to single-sex schools their entire life. I was the first woman they ever saw in this class. And so the contrast with Wisconsin was so great.
Mm-hmm.
And I then, you know, I was not a traditional feminist, but I got the women students together, and I had a party, you know, for the women, incoming women students, which many of the women talked to me about were extremely shocked. Because they didn't see that, you know, they were not interested in being identified as women, and that was quite a radical thing that I did then. So the answer is that I felt completely integrated.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that there was any. And it's interesting because I didn't feel that there was any discrimination against me, that I could do anything I wanted. My close friends, one became a doctor, many went to graduate school, the people that I knew. But it is true that there was a bunch of women who, you know, who were very smart, very active, and they got married and they didn't. Did you see the Mona Lisa smile?
No, with
Julia Roberts.
No, I didn't see it.
Well, it's pretty bad, but it does capture a little bit. That's about
Is it a prep school?
Wellesley. No, it's about Wellesley.
Okay.
It's Wellesley in the 50s. Mm-hmm. It's Wellesley in the 50s. And it was the same period that I was here in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And it's about her shock. And she came from California and from a co-ed school in probably was Berkeley, I think, or whatever she came from. Mm-hmm. And her shock at seeing that. And that was sort of my experience, that Wisconsin was totally co-ed. We were allowed to our ambitions. Most of the women did just marry and go on, but it wasn't as socialized, I think, as it was in the Eastern all-girls school. So I remember somebody, one of the professors at Yale Law School, saying to me how lucky I was going to Wisconsin to have had all that openness and freedom. So it was not only the political, but it also women were very prominent. Helen Rayburn was the president of the student body. There were a lot of very effective and powerful women who went on to other things. Martha Peterson was very helpful with the women. So there was, however, of course, the internal socialization. After I was married, a year after my grad was married when I was 20. Mm-hmm. And though I went to law school, and then I had children, and I stayed home for a while, and then I went back in. So I'm sort of maybe a transition figure or whatever. I was not a proto-feminist then, mm-hmm. but I definitely, or I was, but so I felt from a gender point of view, outside of the sexual, then there were the women who were radical and sexual. There was a bohemian, is the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
I was not part of that. From that point of view, there's a book I would mention to you. I assume you've read that book of essays about Wisconsin in the 50s. Mm-hmm. I never thought it was very good, but it has a lot on this, mm-hmm. much more on the cultural. That I have no idea what was going on. Dave was much more familiar with it than I was.
Yeah.
So I would say Wisconsin was a real. I think the Midwest state schools and possibly the California schools, you know, based on this Julia Roberts thing, had some very astute things and some really dumb things. And I don't know where the information came. I looked at the M to see, because I was quite interested when I saw it. Two men wrote it. I don't know where they got the information. I don't know. And, you know, the funniest thing about that movie is there's a lot of talk about going to law school in the movie. This is the exact period that I went to mm-hmm. Yale Law School. And Julia Roberts is encouraging her students to go to law school. And one of them gets married, and the other one finally decides who she said. Yes, she said. The student says, I think I can get in, but both mentioned the times they mentioned Yale Law School, to the Yale Law School, because they have a quota for women, mm-hmm. but there's always one informer that goes to a Wellesley girl. Mm-hmm. I fell off my seat because they always denied that. It's been a big fight among mm-hmm. the students, my women friends who went there, about whether mm-hmm. or not there was a quota. And that the fact there was a position for Wellesley, so my friend from the Yale Law School went back and checked, and lo and behold, In that period, there was usually one woman from Wellesley.
Every year.
So I thought about that. Now, where did they get this information?
Yeah,
I fell off my chair when I saw it. And I looked carefully in the credits. So this is an area that's quite contested about the discrimination subsequently.
Yeah.
And, of course, documented was discrimination against Jews, mm-hmm. but not at the Yale Law School. That was long gone. I mean, there were many Jews who went to the Yale Law School in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, but that was whether or not there was gender discrimination, that's very contested now. Mm. I thought it was a great, I mean, in that sense, I just didn't feel any of that. Because I was a Ford student, I was also young, you know, so I had all these different things.
So you and your cohort, your friends, colleagues, certainly were looking forward to marriage, but we're also looking forward to a career.
Yeah.
You believe both of those were in your future.
Absolutely. And I believe that I could do both. And Dave and I were plaintiffs now, you know, this is the week they're celebrating, Griswold. We were plaintiffs in the early version of the Griswold lawsuit on birth control.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we've had quite a colorful career. starting with membership. That's why I'm telling you, this period is really quite seminal, both for us personally and politically.
Yeah.
We were plaintiffs in the early, there were two Griswold cases. The one that's the 40th anniversary is Griswold v. Connecticut, which mm-hmm. was the one that threw out the Connecticut. We were Yale law students, and mm-hmm. we were recruited to say that because we took the position that I was entitled to take birth control so I could combine family with work, so I was an actual living example. But that case was thrown out because they didn't actually, because they said there was no real threat to us. We didn't have standing, as they say, because they had not actually, we had not actually been prosecuted. So after that, they opened an office in New Haven, a birth, Planned Parenthood, to break the law, and that was closed down. And that case that we were not on is what the 40th anniversary is this week.
That's interesting.
There's a book by David Garrow. He interviewed us, if you want to read that. I can't remember what it's called. You know, the guy that wrote the book on the on discrimination, on Martin Luther King.
Yeah,
he wrote a subsequent one on birth, on the birth control.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
okay.
You can find it. And so we're cited in there.
That's one of those cases that I've taught intro to political, to American government a couple times. That's one of those cases that is often talked about.
Yes, it's a very important case, and if every once in a while somebody contacts us and wants to interview us or note that, because they, our name is listed in the first case. The others were Doe and Roe, Roe v. Connecticut, I think is the one that we were involved in, and they look and they see our name, so every once in a while somebody notes that.
Yeah. You mentioned Martha Peterson.
Yes.
Were there other women in the administration or on the faculty that you were familiar with, or that provided a kind of mentor?
That's a good point. No.
No,
and I have no recollection of any. Well, Helen C. White was important for Dave. You know, she, but not as a mentor, a feminist mentor. But Martha Peterson definitely identified me as somebody, and she definitely helped me. There were almost all male professors, I think. I'm trying to think who I remember. ILS, they were all male. And history, they were all male. But that didn't, I created my own set of mentors. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt, who were the other people that I thought of? There was Jane Addams.
Frances Perkins, maybe?
Frances Perkins, yeah. But more Jane Addams, because I'm more in the activist end. And so I saw those people as my mentors. And there were women. There were women students. I say Helen Rabine, and there were other women. It wasn't like I was, I mean, because I tell you, when I went to the Yale Law School, walked in that first, I couldn't believe it. I had no idea.
Really?
Absolutely no idea until I walked in that door how few women there were.
That's remarkable that you wouldn't have known that ahead of
time. No, I wouldn't. See, nobody discouraged. Now, we had mortarboard. We had women's merit groups. And that was important. We had I was not in the junior one. I was in the senior one. It was called mortarboard. Still here. I don't know what they've done with those groups. It's just been, they were segregated, most of them, and so. But the women in that group, and that was the women the year before selected the women, was peer, you know, selected the next group. And particularly one of those women, who was actually in literature, had seen me. Eaton Groves Co-op at the Green Lantern or something, and she had seen me or read about me, and she put me in that group, and she was very helpful. She turned out to be a professor of my daughter's, it turned out at Oberlin, an interesting woman. But she was somebody who just was impressed with me, but for instance, writing letters of recommendation, you know, I applied to all the law schools, and I got into everybody, you know, the elite law schools, and I got into them all, and I don't recall anybody saying anything to me, oh, you know, would you go to, nobody like Julia Roberts, but those people in Wellesley, I just did all myself, and I had no idea that Citrick, I think Citrick was the only other person, there wasn't one person, you all did it separately, you know.
No one said it's going to be hard to get in.
No, nobody said that. Nobody, on the other hand, advised me I'd be one of the few women. There was no advising of that type. But there was no, I had to get recommendations, I assume. There were letters of recommendation from somebody or other.
It's interesting because in a lot of ways, what the story you told me squares with a lot of other things I found about women who, I mean, certainly looked forward to marriage, family, etc. But were clearly, from the beginning, committed unthinkingly about to a career, many of them in teaching or something like that, but certainly something.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, I have a friend that I knew who said, I'm going to get married and stay home and take care of my kids.
Yeah.
Now, some of them were more, you know, some of them were interested in being high school, some of my friends became high school teachers. at that period, and some of them went into other things. Right. But they were, as I say, my best, and I became a doctor, and she went became a doctor, and went, another one into graduate school. The women in mortarboard were achieving. That probably was a strong support group. Now, in these political activities, now, you know, I was one of the only women. As you think about all these people, I was probably the only woman I can think of. Now, Helen, you know, there were people in student government, mm-hmm. but among this left group, there were women, but they were more into the bohemian and less into the political.
Really? Okay.
I'm thinking, you know, have we named a woman besides me here now? No. There were certainly women.
Nina Landau's name came up, but she was...
Nina Landau was... She was not. She was married to Saul, and right, I think that was it. I don't remember her being. They were not friends of mine, though. See, Dave was more hung out with the. They were not my personal friends. So I guess that I had that kind of. But I didn't feel that I was fighting. I felt that I was very supportive. Mm-hmm. And of course, then I went to law school. I was single that first year. But of course, I had all this attention, though I was already engaged to Dave, because I was one of the few women.
Right.
So I was quite, and that was true in Wisconsin too when I came to the Ford student. There was a kind of funny advantage that I have, that I never competed with other women for men's attention, since I was one of the few women in that field. And then I was married to Dave. So my experience in law school was much less dramatic than my friend who believes that was all that discrimination was. Not it was alone, you know, and went out and did get married several years later. She was much more conscious of what she felt was discrimination at the Yale Law School than I was. And I think the married situation helped, you know, kind of, certainly I saw that there were very few women. And I found this, I never talked in class. I mean, I always tell the story. I never once spoke in class without being called in 3 years. Well, I was this big activist at Yale. Well, I was this big activist in Wisconsin. So, I mean, clearly it had that effect on me. Definitely, but I was never interested in corporate law. So the fact that I was didn't become a famous corporate lawyer had very little to do with discrimination. I think had much more, though. Nowadays they would say so. I would say because I wasn't interested. So who are these people, you women, you talked to who felt that they were? Who are the other people you're talking about?
Well, I haven't actually. There are a few women that I listened to interviews conducted by the UW Oral History Project.
Were there in this period?
Were there in this period. They're not necessarily activist women. One woman's name was, I think it was Irwin, and another was Harriet. They were, you know, the UW Oral History Project has kind of a very broad reach and has done a lot of different interviews for a lot of different reasons, not just of this kind of activist group. So I haven't actually talked to any women from this period.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and
directly,
that may also reflect again, Wisconsin invented the 60s. Mm-hmm. That a lot of the feminists, the people like Betty Friedan, those came out of those all women schools. Mm-hmm. You know, didn't Betty Friedan go to Smith? And in again this. You know, the Mona Lisa, it's worthwhile taking a look at because, as I say, it really falls apart. But it has some good moments in there. Those schools, I think, were trained the women. I mean, were much more tension-ridden and ambivalent about the role of women. And I think the war, and that it was a real desire to break out of that.
Yeah.
While Wisconsin never fluctuated that much in other words, it had a long time. And when I went to the Yale Law School, there were more women in law school in the 30s at the Yale Law School than there were in the early 60s, 50s and 60s. So there was this kind of, and Wisconsin had this, I can't say tradition of women leaders, but it didn't. And it was very late to have women even in the legislature. But certainly the university didn't have that. Now, on sexual issues, it did. And it had this, the women had to live in the, certain dorms and all that kind of thing.
Right. They've got quite an archive here.
Well, I found it all. I found the octopus, and I found the second volume, and I found the new idea.
You did.
When do you think you sent me this, Dave?
I don't know, Louise.
The Valentine's card. I think maybe it went to that February Valentine. That's when we started going out.
1957.
Right?
57. Well, it's stuff from the...
Did you find the girl's car thing then?
I couldn't... there's all sorts of stuff piled in front of the file. I couldn't figure out how you could have gotten it in there. Okay, so it turned out... Let me tell you about the new idea while she's doing that. What happened was that I started the new idea and we didn't have any money, and we did it. See, this is so number one, number three, number four, number two. This must have been number one. Number five. Volume one, number five. Why are there two volume one, number?
This is number four.
There's two copies of
it. April 5.
There's two copies of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So this must have been the first one. Only grand. Yeah, this is the first one.
And the new idea was kind of a literary, cultural arts magazine, right? Something.
Was like a promo for Living Girls Talk. Now, that was not the year I lived there. Yes, it was. 53, 54, 54, 55, but there's no picture of me there.
Dory Jackson.
Yes.
That name rings a bell.
Yeah. And Ruby Goody, so everybody knew her. She was white. She was there. But she's in that picture of on the front of Groves Co-op, that picture in the on Wisconsin. That I've got a lot of letters about that. That picture in front of Groves Co-op. Almost everybody ended up being identified.
Mm. And this is a picture of the building, huh?
Yeah. And the rest of it's a description of. You can take that with you as long as you copy and get it back to me.
Sure, that'd be great. You know, there is a. The State Historical Society, the Wisconsin Historical Society, has an archive on the Green Lantern, with the history of the Green Lantern, which was written back in the 60s, and some other items. And it talks about its connection to Groves Co-op and Harold Groves, but not much on Groves Co-op in particular.
Now, see, there were a lot of tremendous men, people like Harold Groves, and Jim Crow was a big, now he's still alive.
Is he?
You bet.
Really?
You bet. He plays the violin. He was over here when the Ford students were here for the reunion.
I didn't know that.
Oh, he's as sharp and as active as you can imagine. He would be a person to talk to. Dave was involved. Talk with him. Did you talk with him about these issues?
Not about these issues, no. Oh, a little bit, because he was interested in it. I loaned him my copy of the biography of him. Okay, so here's what we have. We have the octopus.
Are those the same issues?
I'm trying to figure out. So these are extra copies for two. I think it's two different years. Here's me and the chocolate shop.
I think you gave this to me in February 57, Dave. How's that look?
Could be.
It looks preliminary. It doesn't say love, Dave, or anything.
This is the ROTC issue. I told you about the ROTC issue.
Right.
And so there were people from, you know, who didn't like us laughing at the ROTC and actually broke up our little...
And you were making fun of it even though you were a member of the ROTC.
Yeah. Well, you see, I was a complicated guy. Okay, so it looks to me like what we got here is two different years. One that was bound and one that wasn't bound. That's the octopus. Then we have the new idea, which is two, three, four, five. So this is the new idea that I was the editor of, which is the newsprint version.
And then
they got some money.
There's a lot of correspondence up there I found where we contributed money to this. I mean, small amounts.
You personally?
Yeah. You know, for some reason I found a letter saying, my Uncle Leo Jacobson contributed $5. I don't quite know why that happened, especially since I was gone by then. But anyway, there it is. There's that. There's that. This is an extra copy. Yeah.
Now, you said there was some editorial there about...
Murray Richard Roseman. That's the guy that Louise is going out with. Mm. Leroy Luberg, Richard Hartshorne. They were all players in the great membership list. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this was toward the end. Okay, so.
Oh, another thing about Wisconsin that was unique was this strong... When I went to the Yale Law School...
Return on Pain of Death?
Absolutely.
I realized was not only the strong co-ed, but the relationship between the undergraduates and the graduates was unheard of in most, certainly these elite small schools they didn't have. And in places like Yale, there was no contact.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody at the Yale Law School knew anybody who's an undergraduate or graduate schools, you know, very disciplinarily separated. And that whole interaction between undergraduates and graduates, which I think has continued a little bit to this day, don't you think, Dave? I don't
know. What do we know?
What do we know? I mean, I don't know how much you think of this, but I mean, they have the honors program. I mean, they try to, but I mean, that was it was organic. It was just genuine. I mean, people were interested, and there was no artificial. Now there were very few women in graduate students, you know,
right.
And all that.
Right.
But I don't know. It didn't bother me. I never. But I thought about law, and I saw there were famous women who were in law. Now that I talk about it, I don't know who they are. I didn't know any women lawyers. I didn't know any lawyers at all.
No, David mentioned, you mentioned this connection. David mentioned the history department being important as kind of a nexus.
Was more so for Dave than for me.
You were
I was a history major as well, but I was not, didn't hang out with those guys. I didn't take the advance. You know, Dave was more intellectually ambitious than I was. He took the special reading with Merle Purdy. I never would have thought of that. But I got better grades than Dave always, because I graduated magna cum laude. Graduated from lab. That was a big thing in our graduation.
Respect, boy. She had some fancy thing there.
I'm Phi Beta Kappa. But he was the outstanding junior man, and I was never the outstanding junior or senior man. But
I was an Iron Cross.
No, that wasn't as important to me. I was always, but Dave was not as fixated on law. In fact, if I hadn't gone to law school, and then he'd go along with me, because I went the first year, and he came the second year, my second year, and entered the second year, the first year, the year behind. He says he might not have gone. He might have gone to graduate school. Yeah. So I was the one that was determined. You know, relatively early on, I realized that's what I wanted to do, and I just applied to the law school, and I went.
Now, so the faculty members in the history department, like Merle Curdy or...
There were no significance to me. I don't remember one faculty member being important. Now, in ILS, it was a very lovely atmosphere. That's what the Ford students, they just...
That was a two-year program.
A two-year program, and you took most of your courses in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to me at the reunion how important they all felt that was to them. And they were people mostly went into sciences. Though of the people that return, that isn't so true as demographically it's true of the group. So it's interesting because I wouldn't have ranked ILS that high, but obviously it was important, and I'm not certainly putting it down. I certainly didn't feel like I wandered around there, didn't know what to take. And by the time the junior year came, I took some political science, but I clearly was I was a history major, took a lot of courses, the same courses a day for history, but none of the professors seemed to me to be an influence.
Okay.
It was the graduate. It was that world, that politically.
What an interesting time, huh?
Well, that's what we all said when we had the reunion.
Sounds like you talk about this with your colleagues and
In retrospect, you know, when we talk with them, and we all agree, you know, it is. I don't think it's only nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was an extremely interesting time, and I don't think Wisconsin is as interesting now. Now, in the 60s, it became interestingly different, but I don't think now.
It's much more generic today.
Yes. It's more generic. There are some distinctions, some distinctive qualities. I mean, the law school, for example, has some distinctive qualities. And that history at Wisconsin is not to be, it still lingers. It's funny because I'm involved now in healthcare reform issues, and I've been working a little with the medical school. And the dean has of the medical school has resigned, and they're starting a search for the one. And John Wiley talked to the search committee. I've heard this story from several people, and he said, healthcare costs are out of control. I don't like the way the healthcare system is going. Do I want a new dean who's going to lead us like the Wisconsin idea, and we're going to be like the unemployment insurance? We're going to reform the healthcare system. Now, in a sense, the people in healthcare just think it's the funniest thing they ever heard because, you know, give us a break. But on the other hand, the fact that he could imagine such a thing, that he could imagine, and of course, those of us who are reformists, as I am, it's a great opportunity. But I mean,
he could draw on this Wisconsin tradition,
and he could envision. He is a scientist who's uninterested in law and governance, uninterested in any of these things. He's not done well by the law school. He's done well by the social sciences. But he can see that as something that Wisconsin could do, not knowing exactly how to do it. Now, our job is to tell him exactly where he should spend his money to accomplish that. But so that's the kind of thing that kind of lingers out there. And I gave a presentation just from this conference I was at about healthcare reform, and I was quite optimistic. And one of the guys in the audience says, "Oh," he said, "you're just from Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, they believe you can do these things. And oh, West Virginia, nothing will happen there. It's just, you're just..." So, I mean, there is this kind of... But this kind of detail, this kind of thing that actually went on here, that's not here. I mean, so that's why it can't repeat itself now, right? Mm-hmm. Because it isn't in depth, and it isn't organic, and it isn't all these people together. So it's something John Wiley, it's a shard he can pick up from the past, and maybe we can create that if we're very lucky.
Yeah.
But it's not like John Wiley has any, knows how to do it, or he sees it happening, or whatever. Right. So it was a very unique period, and that's why you're studying it, huh? And why did you, can I ask you why you picked it?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember back, so you're not the first person to ask that. I'm trying to remember back to know why I did pick it. When I got here, started hearing some of these stories about the 1960s and Madison and, student protests and this Dow chemical protest in 1967 and Sterling Hall bombing in 1970 and some of these things. And just kind of became progressively more interested, decided to write a seminar paper on it, decided to write my master's thesis on it, and it just kind of grew from there.
But then you went back to the 50s.
Then, well... The 60s has been...
Written up.
The 60s have been done.
Right?
So the final, well, where I am right now at least, is that, you know, there's going to be whatever, 6-7 chapters in my dissertation, and half of them, 3 or 4, are going to be on the 1950s, and 3 or 4 on the 1960s. And so it'll be an attempt to kind of bring them together in some ways and to show the connections and to talk about the Cold War in particular as... kind of this providing a context for a lot of the activism in the 1950s, as well as what happens in the 1960s, the changes in the university as well. I mean, we haven't really talked about that at all, but that's another aspect of my project, talking about the growth of the university, the increase in federal funding related to the Cold War, you know, defense funding, those kinds of things, of research projects and sciences.
Yeah.
And the kind of subsequent... growth in enrollment and the destabilization of the university in some ways as a result of that enrollment, at least over the short term. So those are some of the other things that's kind of another more institutional edge of this project that I'm talking about.
Who's your thesis advisor?
I have a couple of different folks that I'm working with. Both of them are younger faculty members. One is a guy named Tony Michaels, who does, his field is American Jewish history, actually. And the other is Jeremy Suri, whose field is diplomatic history. But
and why is his name familiar?
He's Allison's husband.
Oh, Allison, that's right. The famous Allison.
Famous Allison. Here it is. Here's the final decision of membership of June 7th.
Slick sees no immediate membership list. That's quite
or
a
immediate.
Yeah. That's quite a... So there it is, June 7th, right around graduation. Right?
Yeah, graduation is later, those years.
June 21st, yeah, that is a lot later.
No, well, it was a lot later. We went through June. It was great. We had these wonderful June days like this in Madison. I loved it. I was so, when I came, we came back, and I said, oh, my God, we lost that. It was wonderful. And there was a long period between the end of exams and graduation.
I have one more idea.
So we used to hang out. It was great.
I noticed as I read through the Cardinal that there was a break for the winter holidays,
yeah.
And you came back to finish the first semester, the fall semester.
Sure,
the fall semester
right.
Didn't end until late January.
That's right.
Like
that's
that.
Right. You took the exams. You went back, and then you took the exams. And, then and then the second semester started in early February,
right.
And that's why you went through June.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And then all schools changed them, almost
yeah.
all. Harvard, though, still has a very late. They have one of the few places that goes well into June.
Really?
Yeah. But they also have this long reading period, so the professors don't teach that much longer, but they have this long break. And you actually, I think, get all your grades and everything when you actually graduate.
Yeah.
It's
not
like
right about John Gruber. He is here.
He is here at the university, huh?
Just retired. He's listed in the student, in the directory.
And he was another editor of the Cardinal.
Yeah.
Or he was, I think he became the next
editor.
I think he became the next editor. Holzhuter was involved, but I think Gruber then took it over. In any event, he just retired. It says here, editor emeritus, G-Serv Univ Commit. I don't know what that means, anyway. Anyway, and it's in the book here, John E. Gruber. That's the same guy.
Okay.
Sure. And I got another name for you. If you want to find someone who was more sort of a centrist, liberal Democrat, a real liberal Democrat,
a real Democrat, yeah.
As opposed to whatever we were.
Yeah.
Or I was and she was. And that's this guy, Jim Burt, who's been the president of the Wisconsin Alumni Association.
U-R-T?
B-U-R-T. B-U-R-T. Here is I just got this off the alumni website. And I believe that Jim Burt was in Iron Cross. But I know he's a redundant. I've seen him from time to time. And he was, somebody who was in Iron Cross, I know, was Steve Ambrose. And I know they brought Steve Ambrose back here on some fancy visiting thing, and Jim Burt was a big player in organizing that. So if you want to talk to somebody who comes from another part of the world, of the world of those days, there he is. Anyway, so there's all this stuff. There you go.
It's a treasure trove, huh?
Yeah.
It's been a while since you've looked at these things. So
I found it in a box in the back of the attic.
Yeah, well, you don't pull it out much and look at your clippings. It's too whatever. Well, you have to put that back up. We have to save that card.
There's all my letters from the Army are there.
Yeah.
Right. And my notebooks from law school was, carefully written class notes from law school about soon to be enshrined in the National Archives.
Now, I was thinking about something else. Thinking about, Jewish. I spent some time at Hillel, which was another very positive thing. I mean, they had a wonderful rabbi then, Max Tichton.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not the political. Most of them were Jewish. And that was, there was an anti-Semitic, there was some animal Jewish advisors into that, but obviously they were mostly all Jewish,
mm-hmm.
mostly from New York. So this was the radical outside.
It was mostly all Jewish.
Of the left.
Right.
And that, in the 60s, that really came as a big thing. That's why they wanted to stop out-of-state students. They were considered the agitators. And that started in the 50s. I mean, that was a long-standing tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the Wisconsin students got involved, and I suppose, whatever. But it was very much out-of-state students, Jewish, from the East Coast. Very few people from Chicago. Very few people now. Gar was from Racine. Was from Wisconsin.
Was he? Okay.
Yes.
Yes, from a wealthy Jewish family.
In Racine or Kenosha?
Not
Milwaukee, I don't think.
Kenosha, I believe. Kenosha.
I think it was Kenosha.
I actually visited his house. There were, kind of Wisconsin radicals.
Mm-hmm.
That's another part
of
it.
What about Bertel?
From Milwaukee.
He was from Milwaukee.
They weren't
all out of state, right?
No. There was another stream, which were the Ted Cloak, Andrea Cloak, Gar Alfovitz, Bertel Ullman.
Were they all Jewish or were they?
No.
No,
Bertel and Gar were. But there was an effort, which I never saw myself, but, you know, to relate this to the socialists in Milwaukee, to Zeidler and these people. Mm-hmm. Now, Bertel may have been definitely related to that, because he was from Milwaukee, and there was a strong socialist. But I, in my mind, I didn't see that. But that may have been one of the aspects that allowed all this to go on in Wisconsin, was that there was a substantial socialist tradition in Wisconsin, which Zeidler was mayor then. I'm sure, wasn't he? Because he was mayor for a million years. I'm sure he was mayor then. So there was, of course, they were, you know, the sewer socialists and all that. But nonetheless, that was there.
Yeah.
And I think that was a factor. There also were some religious Quakers and liberal Lutherans, or, you know, this was before the right-wing of Lutherans and that kind of thing, where religion was a more humanistic kind of thing. I'm inventing this because I can't say I experienced it, but I think that may have been
a
factor.
No, I think there's a strong Wisconsin element, and it would be a mistake to treat this as a completely, you know, out of state phenomenon. But I think that the sustaining institutional base was the graduate school, particularly the history department. Not only the history department, but I think that my sense is that the most, but partly because they stayed around for a long time. And undergraduates came and went, right? And some of them were even probably assistant professors, or at least, you know, TAs or something. And I can't prove this, but I would think that if you went back and, I mean, for example, I think the people who recruited me to be the head of, this is early dukedom, the Joe Must Go thing in my freshman year, I think Lauren Barrett was a key person. Lauren Barrett was Merle Curtis' TA.
And he spelled it last
name? B-A-R-I-T-Z, I think, Lauren. And he went on to have a pretty distinguished career as a historian, so it'll be easy to find at some place.
John Israel will probably be a source of information on all that, because he
was a history
major. He was a history major and then went on to be a professor of history.
Okay, so other questions?
Wow, we've gone through a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have any other more specific questions. You know, we've kind of covered the various things I wanted to ask you about. I don't know if there's anything else that you've been thinking about this week.
Right. Well, as I say, you know, it's really, it's a good timing because of this On Wisconsin Story and this reunion. But I have to say that, you know, we all agreed that was a wonderful time and it was a great place.
And you thought the quality of the education as well was good?
We thought the quality of the education was excellent. I just said to my daughter the other day that, but Dave, of course, and it's interesting, John Israel made this point too, that Dave and John Israel did journalism, and that really helped their writing. Wisconsin did not do a very good job on the writing end, and that the more conventional, some of the more conventional colleges did better and high schools as well. But that's one of those issues, that big state schools.
I think it was an excellent education, but I think that it was to some degree an accidental education in this sense. ILS was very structured, so if you went into ILS, at least for your first 2 years, you got a highly structured, very sophisticated education with a group of highly motivated, very intelligent people, none of whom were worrying about Badger Block. But if you were just thrown into the general student population, there was practically none of the sort of organized support structures that they ended up having, like cross-college advisory service. There was really no effective advisory service once you got out of the ILS. And at least that I knew of. And no honors program. I did an honors thesis because I decided to do an honors thesis. There was no such thing. I walked into it and I wanted to do an honors thesis, right? I wanted to do a big research project for my senior year rather than take some more courses. But nobody. It was my idea. I don't know how I got the idea. I think some of these history graduate students that I hung out with suggested I did. So I think that what's important to understand is that if you're highly motivated and sophisticated so that you could get into some of the advanced courses, and even into graduate level courses. I could talk my way into a couple of graduate level courses. You could really do very well. But if you were just, you know, a little disorganized and not highly motivated, you could float in badger block land.
But on the other hand, it was very fluid when you wanted to. There weren't the barriers of women and men, and graduate and undergraduate. A lot of interdisciplinarity. So I think in that point of view, it was a very, very rich, open kind of place.
It was the openness, and of course, all of this sort of political life and cultural life going on, journals and student politics, and there was this whole world that was really, you know, created by the students and outside of the formal structures, but, you know, was if it wasn't encouraged, at least it was not discouraged, and it was, and you know, you got a little support in it. I got support, and that's why the Dean of Men made me that junior man of the year.
That's right, we got support. We got, I mean, Martha Pima, so there was support for this from, but not the funny, it's more the administrative people than the professors, actually.
And both of us got a lot of support.
Yeah, it's interesting. The administrators are not from the professors.
And I got support from the Dean of Men. I got to know the Dean of Men because he almost kicked me out of school.
And then signed you up for the octopus,
and then signed me up for the octopus because I had done such a great job of defending myself that he was impressed.
Now, when did the two of you come back to Madison?
In 73.
73. So that was a big, you know, shock to us, coming back. And 14 years, we'd never come back in between.
Oh, really? You never visited?
Never came back. We were on our way to wherever. And coming back was a big, big thing for us. And in retrospect, I think that when we came, bloody as we were, we would, people say it's probably true that the fact that Wisconsin offered us the job and we knew that we could live here made a big difference. And, you know, we might have done other things if Wisconsin hadn't been the one to offer Dave the job. But it was very hard when we came back of course it was completely different. There was virtually nobody, you know, an occasional person. There's nobody in the law school. We came back for completely different reasons. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I can't go to the Rascal, really. And I also can't go to the Bascom Hall, that lecture room there. That's still there. I mean, I still can't go there without, you know, extreme flashbacks. So.
I have one more name for you. Arthur Hubby. Have you come across Hubby?
I've talked to Hubby. Yeah.
Okay, so there's...
Yeah, I meant.
He was the commander of the military police battalion. Yes, sir. He was...
He told me he was in the MP.
Yeah, no, so was I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was the big ROTC guy. He was Mr. ROTC. So there's another perspective. Jim Burke was Mr. Democratic. Mr. Democrat, Arthur was Mr. ROTC. Now, are there any... Saul Landau was Mr. Sneaky Lefty.
And Helen Raybon, it's too bad. Did they ever do oral? There's no oral history with her.
No, Jack, I think Jack Holzhuter talked about her as well.
Yeah. She was a very impressive person.
And Gruber, it turns out, is in Madison. I thought I remembered seeing Gruber. So he's another, he lived through all this. He wrote all these stories. About membership lists and stuff. So. Okay. So
thanks again.
Oh, you're very welcome.
This was quite an adventure.